Part 3, Montreal. Tour 10, The Birth of Montreal. We come now to an enterprise, as singular in its character, as it proved important in its results. At La Flèche, in Anjou, dwelt one Jérôme Leroyer de la Diversière, receiver of taxes. His portrait shows us a round, bourgeois face, somewhat heavy perhaps, decorated with a slight mustache, and redeemed by bright and earnest eyes. In his head he wears a black skull cap, and over his ample shoulders spreads a stiff white collar, of wide expanse and studious plainness. Though he belonged to the noblesse, his look is that of a grave burgher, of good renown and sage deportment. Diversière was, however, an enthusiastic devotee, of mystical tendencies, who whipped himself with a scourge of small chains till his shoulders were one wound, or a belt with more than 1200 sharp points, and invented for himself other torments, which filled his confessor with admiration. One day, while at his devotions, he heard an inward voice commanding him to become the founder of a new order of hospital nuns, and he was further ordered to establish, in the island called Montreal, in Canada, a hospital, or hotel bureau, to be conducted by these nuns. But Montreal was a wilderness, and the hospital would have no patients. Therefore, in order to supply them, the island must first be colonized. Diversière was greatly perplexed. In the one hand, the voice of heaven must be obeyed. In the other, he had a wife, six children, and a very moderate fortune. Again, there was at Paris a young priest, about 28 years of age, Jean-Jacques Collier, afterwards widely known as founder of the Seminary of St. Sulpice. Judged by his engraved portrait, his countenance, all marked both with energy and intellect, was anything but prepossessing. Every lineament proclaims the priest. Yet the Abbé Ollier has high titles to esteem. He signalized his piety, it is true, by the most disgusting exploits of self-mortification, but, at the same time, he was strenuous in his efforts to reform the people and the clergy. So zealous was he for good morals, that he drew upon himself the imputation of a leaning to the heresy of the Jansenists, a suspicion strengthened by his opposition to certain priests, who, to secure the faithful in their allegiance, justified them in lives of licentiousness. Yet Ollier's Catholicity was past attainment, and in his horror of Jansenists he yielded to the Jesuits alone. He was praying in the ancient church of Saint Germain des Prés, when, like Diversière, he thought he heard a voice from heaven, saying that he was destined to be a light to the Gentiles. It is recorded as a mystic coincidence attending this miracle, that the choir was at that very time chanting the words, Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, and it seems to have occurred neither to Ollier nor to his biographer, that, falling on the ear of the rapt worshipper, they might have unconsciously suggested the supposed revelation. But there was a further miracle. An inward voice told Ollier that he was to form a society of priests, and establish them on the island called Montreal, in Canada, for the propagation of the true faith, and writers old and recent assert that, while both he and Diversière were totally ignorant of Canadian geography, they suddenly found themselves in possession, they knew not how, of the most exact details concerning Montreal, its size, shape, situation, soil, climate, and productions. The annual volumes of the Jesuit Relations, issuing from the renowned press of Cramoisy, were at this time spread broadcast throughout France, and, in the circles of haute devotion, Canada and its missions were everywhere the themes of enthusiastic discussion, while Champlain, in his published works, had long before pointed out Montreal, has the proper site for a settlement. But we are entering a region of miracle, and it is superfluous to look far for explanations. The illusion, in these cases, is a part of the history. De Bercier pondered the revelation he had received, and the more he pondered, the more was he convinced that it came from God. He therefore set out for Paris, to find some means of accomplishing the task assigned him. Here, as he prayed before an image of the Virgin in the Church of Notre Dame, he fell into an ecstasy, and beheld a vision. "I should be false to the integrity of history," writes his biographer, "if I did not relate it here." And he adds, that the reality of this celestial favor is past doubting, inasmuch as De Bercier himself told it to his daughters. Christ, the Virgin, and Saint Joseph appeared before him. He saw them distinctly. Then he heard Christ ask three times of his Virgin Mother, "Where can I find a faithful servant?" In which, the Virgin, taking him, De Bercier, by the hand, replied, "See, Lord, here is that faithful servant," and Christ, with a benignant smile, received him into his service, promising to bestow on him wisdom and strength to do his work. From Paris he went to the neighboring Chateau of Meudon, which overlooks the valley of the Seine, not far from St. Cloud. Entering the gallery of the old castle, he saw a priest approaching him. It was Ollier. Now we are told that neither of these men had ever seen or heard of the other, and yet, says the pious historian, impelled by a kind of inspiration, they knew each other at once, even to the depths of their hearts, saluted each other by name, as we read of St. Paul, the Hermit, and St. Anthony, and of St. Dominic and St. Francis, and ran to embrace each other, like to friends who had met after a long separation. "Monsieur," exclaimed Ollier, "I know your design, and I go to commend it to God at the holy altar." And he went at once to say Mass in the chapel. De Bercier received the communion at his hands, and then they walked for 3 hours in the park, discussing their plans. They were of one mind, in respect both to objects and means, and when they parted, Ollier gave De Bercier 100 louis, saying, "This is to begin the work of God." They proposed to found at Montreal 3 religious communities, 3 being the mystic number, 1 of secular priests to direct the colonists and convert the Indians, 1 of nuns to nurse the sick, and 1 of nuns to teach the faith to the children, white and red. To borrow their own phrases, they would plant the banner of Christ in an abode of desolation and a haunt of demons, and to this end a band of priests and women were to invade the wilderness, and take post between the fangs of the Iroquois. But first they must make a colony, and to do so must raise money. Ollier had pious and wealthy penitents, De Bercier had a friend, the Baron de Fancamp, devout as himself and far richer. Anxious for his soul, and satisfied that the enterprise was an inspiration of God, he was eager to bear part in it. Ollier soon found 3 others, and the 6 together formed the germ of the Society of Notre Dame de Montreal. Among them they raised the sum of 75,000 livres, equivalent to about as many dollars at the present day. Now to look for a moment at their plan. Their eulogists say, and with perfect truth, that, from a worldly point of view, it was mere folly. The partners mutually bound themselves to seek no return for the money expended. Their profit was to be reaped in the skies, and, indeed, there was none to be reaped on earth. The feeble settlement at Quebec was at this time in danger of utter ruin, for the Iroquois, enraged at the attacks made in them by Champlain, had begun a fearful course of retaliation, and the very existence of the colony trembled in the balance. But if Quebec was exposed to their ferocious inroads, Montreal was incomparably more so. A settlement here would be a perilous outpost, a hand thrust into the jaws of the tiger. It would provoke attack, and lie almost in the path of the war parties. The associates could gain nothing by the fur trade, for they would not be allowed to share in it. In the other hand, danger apart, the place was an excellent one for a mission, for here met two great rivers, the St. Lawrence, with its countless tributaries, flowed in from the west, while the Ottawa descended from the north, and Montreal, embraced by their uniting waters, was the key to a vast inland navigation. Thither the Indians would naturally resort, and thence the missionaries could make their way into the heart of a boundless heathendom. None of the ordinary motives of colonization had part in this design. It owed its conception and its birth to religious zeal alone. The island of Montreal belonged to Lawson, former president of the Great Company of the Hundred Associates, and his son had a monopoly of fishing in the St. Lawrence. Duversier and Femkamp, after much diplomacy, succeeded in persuading the elder Lawson to transfer his title to them, and, as there was a defect in it, they also obtained a grant of the island from the Hundred Associates, its original owners, who, however, reserved to themselves its western extremity as a site for a fort and storehouses. At the same time, the younger Lawson granted them a right of fishery within 2 leagues of the shores of the island, for which they were to make a yearly acknowledgement of 10 pounds of fish. A confirmation of these grants was obtained from the king. Duversier and his companions were now seigneurs of Montreal. They were empowered to appoint a governor, and to establish courts, from which there was to be an appeal to the Supreme Court of Quebec, supposing such to exist. They were excluded from the fur trade, and forbidden to build castles or forts other than such as were necessary for defense against the Indians. Their title assured, they matured their plan. First they would send out 40 men to take possession of Montreal, entrench themselves, and raise crops. Then they would build a house for the priests, and 2 convents for the nuns. Meanwhile, Allier was toiling at Vaugirard, in the outskirts of Paris, to inaugurate the seminary of priests, and Duversier at La Flèche, to form the community of hospital nuns. How the school nuns were provided, for we shall see hereafter. The colony, it will be observed, was for the convents, not the convents for the colony. The associates needed a soldier governor to take charge of their 40 men, and, directed, as they supposed by Providence, they found one wholly to their mind. This was Paul de Chamaday, Sieur de Maisonneuve, a devout and valiant gentleman, who in long service among the heretics of Holland had kept his faith intact, and had held himself resolutely aloof from the license that surrounded him. He loved his profession of arms, and wished to consecrate his sword to the church. Past all comparison, he is the manliest figure that appears in this group of zealots. The piety of the design, the miracles that inspired it, the adventure and the peril, all combined to charm him, and he eagerly embraced the enterprise. His father opposed his purpose, but he met him with the text of Saint Mark, "There is no man that hath left house or brethren or sisters or father for my sake, but he shall receive 100-fold. In this the elder Maisonneuve, deceived by his own worldliness, imagined that the plan covered some hidden speculation, from which enormous profits were expected, and therefore withdrew his opposition. Their scheme was ripening fast, when both Allier and Duversier were assailed by one of those revulsions of spirit, to which saints of the ecstatic school are naturally liable. Duversier, in particular, was a prey to the extremity of dejection, uncertainty, and misgiving. What had he, a family man, to do with ventures beyond sea? Was it not his first duty to support his wife and children? Could he not fulfill all his obligations as a Christian by reclaiming the wicked and relieving the poor of lifeflesh? Plainly, he had doubts that his vocation was genuine. If we could raise the curtain on his domestic life, perhaps we should find him beset by wife and daughters, tearful and wrathful, inveighing against his folly, and imploring him to provide a support for them before squandering his money to plant a convent of nuns in a wilderness. How long his fit of dejection lasted does not appear, but at length he set himself again to his appointed work. A leader, too, emerging from the clouds and darkness, found faith once more, and again placed himself at the head of the great enterprise. There was imperative need of more money, and de Verceer, under judicious guidance, was active in obtaining it. This miserable victim of illusions had a squat, uncourtly figure, and was no proficient in the graces either of manners or of speech. Hence his success in commending his objects to persons of rank and wealth is set down as one of the many miracles which attended the birth of Montreal. But zeal and earnestness are in themselves a power, and the ground had been well marked out and plowed for him in advance. That attractive, though intricate, subject of study, the female mind, has always engaged the attention of priests, more especially in countries where, as in France, women exert a strong social and political influence. The art of kindling the flames of zeal, and the more difficult art of directing and controlling them, have been themes of reflection the most diligent and profound. Accordingly, we find that a large proportion of the money raised for this enterprise was contributed by devout ladies. Many of them became members of the Association of Montreal, which was eventually increased to about 45 persons, chosen for their devotion and their wealth. Allier and his associates had resolved, though not from any collapse of zeal, to postpone the establishment of the seminary and the college, until, after a settlement should be formed. The hospital, however, might, they thought, be begun at once, for blood and blows would be the assured portion of the first settlers. At least, a discreet woman ought to embark with the first colonists as their nurse and housekeeper. Scarcely was the need recognized, when it was supplied. Mademoiselle Jean Mance was born of an honorable family of Nonjantois, and in 1640 was 34 years of age. These Canadian heroines began their religious experiences early. Of Marie de l'Incarnation we read, that at the age of 7 Christ appeared to her in a vision, and the biographer of Mademoiselle Mance assures us, with admiring gravity, that, at the same tender age, she bound herself to God by a vow of perpetual chastity. This singular infant in due time became a woman, of a delicate constitution, and manners graceful, yet dignified. Though an earnest devotee, she felt no vocation for the cloister, yet, while still in the world, she led the life of a nun. The Jesuit relations, and the example of Madame de la Peltrie, of whom she had heard, inoculated her with the Canadian enthusiasm, then so prevalent, and, under the pretense of visiting relatives, she made a journey to Paris, to take counsel of certain priests. Of one thing she was assured, the divine will called her to Canada, but to what end she neither knew nor asked to know, for she abandoned herself, as an atom to be born to unknown destinies on the breath of God. At Paris, Father Saint Jure, a Jesuit, assured her that her vocation to Canada was, past doubt, a call from heaven, while Father Rapin, a Recollet, spread abroad the fame of her virtues, and introduced her to many ladies of rank, wealth, and zeal. Then, well supplied with money for any pious work to which she might be summoned, she journeyed to Rochelle, whence ships were to sail for New France. Thus far she had been kept in ignorance of the plan with regard to Montreal, but now Father Laplace, a Jesuit, revealed it to her. In the day after her arrival at Rochelle, as she entered the church of the Jesuits, she met Cavercier coming out. Then, says her biographer, these two persons, who had never seen nor heard of each other, were enlightened supernaturally, whereby their most hidden thoughts were mutually made known, as had happened already with him. Allier and the same M. de la Cavercier. A long conversation ensued between them, and the delights of this interview were never effaced from the mind of Mademoiselle Mance. She used to speak of it like a seraph, writes one of her nuns, and far better than many a learned doctor could have done. She had found her destiny. The ocean, the wilderness, the solitude, the Iroquois, nothing daunted her. She would go to Montreal with Maisonneuve and his 40 men. Yet, when the vessel was about to sail, a new and sharp misgiving seized her. How could she, a woman, not yet bereft of youth or charms, live alone in the forest, among a troop of soldiers? Her scruples were relieved by two of the men, who, at the last moment, refused to embark without their wives, and by a young woman, who, impelled by enthusiasm, escaped from her friends, and took passage, in spite of them, in one of the vessels. All was ready, the ships set sail, but Allier, Cavercier, and Femkamp remained at home, as did also the other associates, with the exception of Maisonneuve and Mademoiselle Mance. In the following February, an impressive scene took place in the Church of Notre Dame, at Paris. The associates, at this time numbering about 45, with Allier at their head, assembled before the altar of the Virgin, and, by a solemn ceremonial, consecrated Montreal to the Holy Family. Henceforth it was to be called Galerie de Montreal, a sacred town, reared to the honor and under the patronage of Christ, Saint Joseph, and the Virgin, to be typified by three persons on earth, founders respectively of the three destined communities, Allier, Cavercier, and a maiden of Troyes, Marguerite Bourgeois, the seminary to be consecrated to Christ, the Hotel Dieu to Saint Joseph, and the college to the Virgin. But we are anticipating a little, for it was several years, as yet, before Marguerite Bourgeois took an active part in the work of Montreal. She was the daughter of a respectable tradesman, and was now 22 years of age. Her portrait has come down to us, and her face is a mirror of loyalty and womanly tenderness. Her qualities were those of good sense, conscientiousness, and a warm heart. She had known no miracles, ecstasies, or trances, and though afterwards, when her religious susceptibilities had reached a fuller development, a few such are recorded of her, yet even the Abbe Thalen, with the best intentions, can credit her with but a meager allowance of these celestial favors. Though in the midst of visionaries, she distrusted the supernatural, and about her belief that, in his government of the world, God does not often set aside its ordinary laws. Her religion was of the affections, and was manifested in an absorbing devotion to duty. She had felt no vocation to the cloister, but had taken the vow of chastity, and was attached, as an extern, to the sisters of the congregation of Troyes, who were fevered with eagerness to go to Canada. Marguerite, however, was content to wait until there was a prospect that she could do good by going, and it was not till the year 1653, that, renouncing an inheritance, and giving all she had to the poor, she embarked for the savage scene of her labors. To this day, in crowded schoolrooms of Montreal and Quebec, fit monuments of her unobtrusive virtue, her successors instruct the children of the poor, and embalm the pleasant memory of Marguerite Bourgeois. In the martial figure of Maisonneuve, and the fair form of this gentle nun, we find the true heroes of Montreal. Maisonneuve, which has 40 men and 4 women, reached Quebec too late to ascend to Montreal that season. They encountered distrust, jealousy, and opposition. The agents of the Company of the Hundred Associates looked on them askance, and the governor of Quebec, Montmagny, saw a rival governor in Maisonneuve. Every means was used to persuade the adventurers to abandon their project and settle at Quebec. Montmagny called a council of the principal persons of his colony, who gave it as their opinion that the newcomers had better exchange Montreal for the island of Orleans, where they would be in a position to give and receive succor, while, by persisting in their first design, they would expose themselves to destruction, and be of use to nobody. Maisonneuve, who was present, expressed his surprise that they should assume to direct his affairs. "I have not come here," he said, "to deliberate, but to act. It is my duty and my honor to found a colony at Montreal, and I would go, if every tree were an Iroquois." At Quebec there was little ability and no inclination to shelter the new colonists for the winter, and they would have fared ill, but for the generosity of M. Pussoux, who lived not far distant, at a place called Saint Michel. This devout and most hospitable person made room for them all in his rough, but capacious dwelling. Their neighbors were the hospital nuns, then living at the Mission of Sillery, in a substantial, but comfortless house of stone, where, amidst destitution, sickness, and irrepressible disgust at the filth of the savages whom they had in charge, they were laboring day and night with devoted assiduity. Among the minor ills which beset them were the eccentricities of one of their lay sisters, crazed with religious enthusiasm, who had the care of their poultry and domestic animals, of which she was accustomed to inquire, one by one, if they loved God, when, not receiving an immediate answer in the affirmative, she would instantly put them to death, telling them that their impiety deserved no better fate. Early in May, Maisonneuve and his followers embarked. They had gained an unexpected recruit during the winter, in the person of Madame de la Peltrie, foundress of the Ursulines of Quebec. The piety, the novelty, and the romance of their enterprise all had their charms for the fair enthusiast, and an irresistible impulse imputed by a slandering historian to the levity of her sex urged her to share their fortunes. Her zeal was more admired by the Montrealists whom she joined than by the Ursulines whom she abandoned. She carried off all the furniture she had lent them, and left them in the utmost destitution. Nor did she remain quiet after reaching Montreal, but was presently seized with a longing to visit the Hurons, and preach the faith in person to those benighted heathen. It needed all the eloquence of a Jesuit, lately returned from that most arduous mission, to convince her that the attempt would be as useless as rash. It was the 8th of May when Maisonneuve and his followers embarked at Saint Michel, and as the boats, deep laden with men, arms, and stores, moved slowly on their way, the forest, with leaves just opening in the warmth of spring, lay on their right hand and in their left, in a flattering semblance of tranquility and peace. But behind woody islets, in tangled thickets and damp ravines, and in the shade and stillness of the columned woods, lurked everywhere a danger and a terror. In the 17th of May, 1642, Maisonneuve's little flotilla pinnace, A flat-bottomed craft moved by sails, and two rowboats approached Montreal, and all inboard raised in unison a hymn of praise. Montmagny was with them, to deliver the island, in behalf of the Company of the Hundred Associates, to Maisonneuve, representative of the Associates of Montreal. And here, too, was Father Vimont, superior of the missions, for the Jesuits had been prudently invited to accept the spiritual charge of the young colony. In the following day, they glided along the green and solitary shores now thronged with the life of a busy city, and landed in the spot which Champlain, 31 years before, had chosen as the fit site of a settlement. It was a tongue or triangle of land, formed by the junction of a rivulet with the St. Lawrence, and known afterwards as Point Clear. The rivulet was bordered by a meadow, and beyond rose the forest with its vanguard of scattered trees. Early spring flowers were blooming in the young grass, and birds of varied plumage flitted among the boughs. Maisonneuve sprang ashore, and fell on his knees. His followers imitated his example, and all joined their voices in enthusiastic songs of thanksgiving. Tents, baggage, arms, and stores were landed. An altar was raised in a pleasant spot near at hand, and Mademoiselle Mance, with Madame de la Peltrie, aided by her servant, Charlotte Perry, decorated it with a taste which was the admiration of the beholders. Now all the company gathered before the shrine. Here stood Vimont, in the rich vestments of his office. Here were the two ladies, with their servant, Montmagny, no very willing spectator, and Maisonneuve, a laurel-like figure, erect and tall, his men clustering around him, soldiers, sailors, artisans, and laborers, all alike soldiers at need. They kneeled in reverent silence, as the host was raised aloft, and when the rite was over, the priest turned and addressed them. "You are a grain of mustard seed, that shall rise and grow till its branches overshadow the earth. You are few, but your work is the work of God. His smile is on you, and your children shall fill the land." Quote, "The afternoon waned, the sun sank behind the western forest, and twilight came on. Fireflies were twinkling over the darkened meadow. They caught them, tied them with threads into shining festoons, and hung them before the altar, where the host remained exposed. Then they pitched their tents, lighted their bivouac fires, stationed their guards, and lay down to rest. Such was the birth night of Montreal. Is this true history, or the romance of Christian chivalry? It is both. A few years later there was another emigration to Montreal, of a character much like the first. The pious little colony led a struggling and precarious existence. Many of its inhabitants were killed by the Iroquois, and its escape from destruction was imputed to the intervention of the Holy Virgin. The place changed, as years went on, and became a great center of the fur trade, though still bearing strong marks of its pristine character. The institutions of religion and charity planted by its founders remain to this day, and the seminary of St. Sulpice holds vast possessions in and around the city. During the war of 1755-1760, Montreal was a base of military operations. In the latter year, three English armies advanced upon it from three different points, united before its walls, and forced Governor Vaudreuil to surrender all Canada to the British crown.